Joining me in a studio, Professor Ivor Sarakinsky. A very, very good morning. Welcome to Chai FM.
Morning, Howard, and thank you for the invitation.
So, listen, we've been following this week, and I think it's been an incredibly, incredibly important week in South Africa's evolution in part of, as part of our democratic process. What is your overall impression of the week in Parliament?
Manic.
Manic, okay. That's a good word. That probably describes most weeks in South African Parliament.
Indeed. There's been good stuff, and there's been bad stuff. The trajectory is going in the right direction.
All right.
But we shouldn't ignore some of the bad stuff that's happening. Because if one breaks it all down, the bad stuff has the potential to be a break on the reform that needs to take place. So we're watching that dynamic very closely to get an angle on what it's about. So some of the personalities who've now said they don't want to be part of Parliament.
Right, that's positive, right?
It's positive on the one hand, it's negative on the other.
All right, because explain that to us.
What are they going to do now?
Okay.
So in Parliament, you've got to be in Cape Town and you've got to work.
And you've got to conform to certain rules.
And you've got
rules.
To conform and people can keep an eye on you. If you're not in Parliament,
you can... I never thought of that, yeah.
So this is all part of the deep inside ANC politics.
Right.
So these people who withdrawing from Parliament, it looks like that they want to focus their attention within the ANC outside of official public institutions.
Which might be more dangerous, is
yes,
what you're suggesting.
Indeed, because it's to mobilize the branches.
Right.
The ANC is run by the branches. And if you control the branches, you can control significant decision-making process in the future.
So if from a Cyril Ramaphosa perspective, is it better for him that they are in Parliament or out of Parliament?
He needs them in Parliament, the bad guys. Let's use bad guys as a broad, inaccurate descriptor. He needs the bad guys there so that they become part of the system and get constrained by having to comply with basic rules of
Very
how institutions
right.
function. He also doesn't need some of the bad guys in Parliament because they will use the power they have as parliamentarians in oversight committees to obstruct and delay and ask difficult questions in order to undermine processes in terms of the reform cleanup that needs to take place. So that's why it's manic. There's good and bad on just about each and every development. There's a positive and a negative.
Right. And from a public perception point of view, obviously, for me, it's very, you know, the way I looked at it was these people, they're certain people that should not have been in Parliament. To say that they haven't yet been found guilty is a horrible irony considering the NPA was captured. Consider that we had no system that could have found them guilty. So they do need to step aside from a credibility perspective in terms of that. So that is positive. We have seen certain of those characters stepping aside. What do you think will happen with Ace Makhosheleni?
Well, that's what this whole thing centers around. As the Secretary General of the ANC, he's not in Parliament.
Right.
He's in Luthuli House. But the way the ANC works is that Luthuli House is how all the decision-making works, which then flows into those in elected and appointed office. So he's a very powerful figure inside the ANC. And he's playing a very clever game in terms of maneuvering to restrain as much as possible the reform initiatives that are underway, because he's on the receiving end of those reform initiatives. He has a vested interest in obstructing the progress. And a powerful figure. If one looks at NASREC 2017, Cyril didn't come in with a big majority
Not at all.
And that's where the branches are so important. And do the branches understand the importance of reform as opposed to this is how the ANC works? Who's going to win that communication with the people inside the branches?
Do you think with this we've had a shift at all? You know, we, until a couple of years ago, or maybe even just over a year ago, we saw, in fact, probably just before, certainly up until NASREC, we had almost an obsessive ANC that would not discuss its own issues outside of the party. And anybody that did, if they came from within the party, were very, very, they were very severely censured. Have we started to see a shift by, through these, this election with some form of recognition? Yes, we haven't been perfect. Yes, help us reform. Or is that just electioneering?
No, there's been a bit of a sea change in terms of the ANC's attitude to discussing itself in public.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of maturity, and that maturity didn't come voluntarily.
It very rarely does. Most of us really only grow up when we have to.
When you have to, indeed. And the pressure point in terms of the ANC suddenly maturing was a realization if they didn't come clean with the electorate, they would have got hammered even more than they got hammered a week and a half ago.
Mm. And in fact, of course, something that we speak about quite a bit on the show is how well the ANC actually marketed through this election campaign. They almost made us think that we were going towards the American system where we vote for a president, because the posters would say, vote Cyril Ramaphosa for president. That isn't how our system works.
Indeed.
But that was the marketing campaign, and it was a clever campaign, because Cyril Ramaphosa is the image of the party. But that we saw Ace not quite happy with that immediately following the elections and saying, well, actually, no, it was the whole of the ANC that won the elections, not Cyril Ramaphosa. He's wrong. Cyril Ramaphosa won the election from a marketing perspective. There's no question.
Yes. Without Cyril, the numbers would have been much, much worse.
Mm, mm.
So they dropped 5% without that campaign. And it was a clever campaign. It was saying, we acknowledge our mistakes.
Right.
And because we acknowledge our mistakes, trust us again. And it had a lot of success. It was a clear, simple message that was punted at every opportunity. But the dynamic between Ace and Cyril is the giveaway in terms of what's going on deep down within the ANC.
Right. Is that the relationship to watch?
That's the relationship to watch. And those people who've said we're waiting to clear our names with this integrity, integrity commission, which has no power at all.
Right.
And its job is to ensure the public reputation of the ANC as opposed to a legal process. They're circumventing that. Why? It's all part of not staying out of powerful institutions in order to get a foothold in to obstruct, delay, and keep constantly aware of what the other side's doing.
It's fascinating. It's always that statement, I want my day in court, and then you spend the next 10 years fighting not to have your day in court.
That's exactly that.
Because that's how that's. Do you think the week as well with Jacob Zuma going to court and claiming, of course, all sorts of conspiracy theories and outside influences and political agendas. Does that stick at all?
It's a sign of the desperation of that camp inside the ANC in terms of the realization that consequences are coming. They might not be fast, and it might be some years ahead, but there's a realization now that something is going to happen that's not going to be pleasant.
So, yeah,
and it's desperation.
Do you think that consequences are coming? Because I think that's the one, you know, we go through this. A good friend of mine said to me a few weeks ago, that he wishes they wouldn't have the state capture inquiry. And I said, how can you say such a thing? And his answer was, because it's worse if we know in such sordid detail what's gone on and then nothing happens. I'd rather not know and then we just get on with it.
Yeah.
And it kind of changed my perspective. I hear what he was saying. Do you think there will be consequences?
Yes. It's not going to be quick though, because these are technical, complicated corporate fraud, organized crime investigations, and the auditing and the legal case is very, very complicated. So it's coming. There's no doubt. And there's an announcement coming later today on the new appointee in the NPA on who's in charge of investigating these matters.
Right, because one of the issues that we've discussed here in studio, Glynis Breitenbach was very, very supportive of the new head of the NPA, but her big concern was that she said to me that her big concern is that the NPA has been almost hollowed out in terms of skills. If they don't have those skills, there's nothing that they can actually do with that with this information.
Yes, so there has been that hollowing out, and there have been some encouraging appointments of late.
Right.
And I think the process will now start in terms of putting these cases together. But they're really technical cases. Mm. This isn't a quick.
Right.
So the quick way is the income tax, the Al Capone route.
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Find another way in.
Yeah. And get them out the system as quickly as possible. But even though with the constitution and evidence and law and presumptions, you need highly skilled legal teams to play that game well. Mm. Mm. And it's a process of building that institution to do that in, say, 2-3 years further down.
What do you think, how do you think this is going to play out? You know, we saw the EFF obviously having increased their numbers quite significantly, the Sea of Red, making a very, very strong visual impact in Parliament. We'll talk about the DA in just one moment. What's your view on where the EFF goes from this point?
They're the only party that's got a positive future in terms of potential growth. And the reason why I say that is if one looks at the provinces from 2014 and 2019, in 2014 their growth was restricted to about 4 provinces, the northern provinces.
Right.
In this election, they've created quite a strong footprint in the other 5 provinces. And that means that, that there's potential growth there if they mobilize and if they campaign. So now they've got more MPs, more resources, they can campaign better to get those numbers up.
Right.
So their 11% was partly an effect of doing really badly in 5 of the other nine provinces. So their growth will go up. They've got internal problems like all the political parties. There's internal Tsoros.
Right.
They've also got a whole bunch of baggage that's going to come down on them at some point.
Are you talking about the VBS?
The VBS being associated with a known and self-confessed tobacco smuggler.
Right.
All of those scandals at some point are
still
going
coming.
To get processed.
And as well as, you know, and we saw that certainly with the DA, that as a party grows, the systems need to be properly in place. Otherwise, they are going to have tremendous issues.
Yeah, you do need sound systems, and you need to manage conflict much, much better than they've done in the past, because you've got more members, you've got limited positions,
right,
and you've got competition now for internal and public positions,
right,
and if you don't manage that properly, you end up with serious internal divisions that are worse than the internal divisions that they've already got.
Mm.
The DA's also got its own Tsoros. The ANC's got Tsoros.
Right.
The EFF's got Tsoros. They've all got Tsoros.
Is that because we're a young democracy?
I don't think so.
Or is it because we just are still in a turbulent time?
I think it's the times, the issues, the problems the society's facing means that people haven't got a clear vision on how to deal. And inside parties, you don't have a consensus either. You've got different views that aren't reconciled and managed properly.
Right.
And it blows up, and you've got ambition.
Right.
Politics is a nice career.
Well, what was interesting to me, and it seemed to be an insignificant event, but to me, it portrayed a greater picture and conflict within the EFF. And that took place a couple of months ago, where we had that situation at one of the universities, where some of the EFF supporters clearly wearing EFF t-shirts were taking trash out of a dustbin, throwing it on the floor, and this kid was coming, picking it up patiently, putting it away. And that in and of itself, you know, not every political party can control all of its, anyone who identifies with it fully. So that in and of itself, I don't think was so significant. I thought what was significant was that Julius Malema was very clearly, in my view, unable to deal with it. He wasn't, he couldn't quite decide which way to go, and then he went with supporting his own members by saying, well, that kid shouldn't have been disrupting a protest. He just came out very, very badly. And what that said to me was he doesn't have as much strength as he would like to portray that he has within his own party, with his own supporter base, and he was scared to alienate people. So what he did was he made the wrong moral choice publicly in order to continue winning the hearts of his supporters. That to me was a sign of problems still to come for the EFF. What's your thoughts?
Yes, now I go along with that thought. the difference between doing what's morally right and what's politically right. And I think in addition to what you've said there is the consequence of his rhetoric.
Yes.
So he might not want people to go and do this kind of stuff when he says we must slit the throat of whiteness.
Right.
But the point is people out there take that message and interpret it in one way. And some of those actions are clearly pursuing that theme from that inflammatory rhetoric that he uses. And he can't control that. And he doesn't want to control it at some point.
But he deliberately, because he's a populist.
So he says things to get effect. And when the consequence comes, he denies that it's his fault. And that's the ambiguity of being this kind of politician.
And the danger of it, obviously.
Absolute danger.
You know, because, and it's interesting because when you look at, and we discussed it quite intensively this week, is when you see the Helen Ziller tweet, which I thought was inappropriate, I don't think very smart. I think there were certain elements of it that is a conversation that we need to have. But the way in which she did it and the moral equivalence that she tried to create between these two things, I think was wrong. That said, if we look at some of the things that Julius Malema has said, way, 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 way worse. And that's because we've simply come to accept that he talks in a certain way. His image allows him that much flexibility. The DA, which is a party of, you know, who wants to portray themselves in the center of balance, of fairness, can't get away with saying things like that. The danger of that is, when do we take Julius Malema seriously and when don't we?
Well, I'm afraid that we should have been taking his inflammatory statements a lot more serious earlier.
Right.
A pattern has now evolved where he can say these things and people laugh. And then a lot of what he says is not a laughing matter.
Absolutely.
Very, very serious stuff. And there should have been serious, we're using the word consequences a lot. There should have been consequences a lot earlier. And it's unfortunately fallen on individuals now to fight this. So the individual court cases that are coming for the personal attacks, the personal insults, there are a number of people who've now taken him to court. Trevor Manuel, Karima Brown, a journalist.
Right, of course.
Others.
I mean, she
And they're using the legal system now to restrain
him. Right, and she was a perfect example of how he denied that he was, that he was at fault there. And of course he was.
Yeah.
Of course he was.
Absolutely.
I mean, he started a chain reaction. You can't suggest, that. In fact, I was interviewed on Russia Today a few weeks ago and, they played a clip just before they crossed to me on him saying, no, I'm not saying that we need to kill all whites yet. And, you know, we've kind of laughed at that, but the reality is now I'm thinking, you know, watching it being broadcast to 3 million Russia Today international viewers around the world. And it's shocking for somebody who's not used to it. We're used to it. And when that crossed to me, I said, well, you know, I'm obviously immensely relieved that, you know, he doesn't want to kill us yet, that we've got a little bit of time. And I was kind of flippant about it. But the reality is that that's a very serious thing to say.
It's outrageous. It's unacceptable. Trevor Noah in that video clip that did the rounds, brought that to the forefront. And, the EFF wasn't amused.
Yeah.
And what I think Trevor Noah is doing is using comedy to highlight the danger, because that's what clever comedians do of what politicians are saying and doing. It's outrageous. It has to stop. And it seems as if people are too scared to stop.
Right, but nobody is standing up to it.
Yeah. And he uses these press conferences. He calls a press conference. The media arrives, and he gets an hour and a half of free publicity.
Well, isn't
headline news? Very clever.
You know, and my views of Donald Trump aside, that's effectively how he became elected in America. That the guy sneezed, and everybody followed his sneeze. It was to some extent the liberal press that got him elected by their fixation on him, and we are actually mirroring the same process here in South Africa. There is nothing that Julius Malema can do that isn't covered in the press.
Yeah. So he must be covered. The EFF must be covered, but not covered in this fawning way where the headlines just allow him to ventilate and the EFF to ventilate what they feel in the morning when they wake up. A much more critical engagement with what they stand for and what they do.
Well, that's also, again, also my issue. And a few people have mentioned that here, and I don't want to get into an Israel discussion at all because I think it's always quite dangerous to do, not even dangerous. I think it takes us off topic. The EFF wearing Palestinian flags in parliament. To me, a lot of their stuff is skin deep. And I just wonder how much of it is just populist, just to try and, you know, we saw that even in the earlier career of Julius Malema. I've always got the sense that he would take something, throw it against a wall, say all of these outrageous things, and if one thing stuck, well, then that was the thing that he would go for. That seems to be their policy, which makes me not take him seriously in many cases, but that also could be a mistake.
Yeah, it's a scattergun approach. You throw a whole lot of stuff out there and you see what comes back and you turn that into a statement, a policy in terms of getting support. So that's the tactic. It's incredibly dangerous because you say things that have consequences way beyond your control. And that's what is happening in that context. Very, very problematic.
Right, and we are running out of time, but just to talk very quickly about the DA, they obviously had a leadership crisis. I was very impressed with how Mosi Mamoni took responsibility. To me, that's what everything is about. If you can say, look, you know, it's under my leadership that we didn't win again in the elections, I take responsibility. I mean, to me, that is real leadership. But that said, where does the DA go from here?
They're in trouble, I'm afraid. They try to please too many constituencies.
Absolutely, I agree with
you. So you fudge your policy to bring black voters in, and in doing that, you alienate white voters. And it's not just the Freedom Front surge. The alienation is in the wards. If one looks deep into the wards, the voting districts, you see the number of votes that the DA's lost compared to 2014 and 2016. It's significant numbers of traditional DA voters who either stayed away or voted for other parties. And that's what they're going to have to overcome now. And part of that is clear policy. What do you stand for? You can't make everyone happy. Who are you going to make happy in terms of driving an agenda that's going to be in the interest of South Africa as a whole? And until they get clarity on that, big trouble. And until they deal with their internal divisions, vicious internal fights, Helen Ziller's tweets are not simply the meanderings of a deranged person.
Oh, I don't think so at all.
They tactical interventions.
I couldn't agree more.
In terms of serious internal divisions inside the DA itself.
Right. That's, in fact, what I don't like about it is I think it's very unfair to a large extent what she's doing. She needs to, if these conversations need to be had within the DA, then she needs to have them within the DA. She needs to, but to force this conversation on the DA in the way in which she's doing, I don't believe is the right thing to do. Time is 7:55. I've been chatting with Professor Ivor Sarakinski. That was absolutely fascinating. Thank you. And if you don't mind, we're definitely going to be bringing you back again from time to time to have these conversations.
No, thank you. Thank you for the invitation, Howard. I enjoyed that. And thanks for the kind words. And yes, I'd love to do this again.
Absolutely fantastic. Time is 7:55.